Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 31st, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. Good to have you along for our conversation. So in the this past winter in Boston, in the fine city of Boston, there were two significant storms that led to flooding in iconic places up and down the coast, but particularly down where all the video was taken. It was down near Boston Aquarium and the Aquarium T-Stop, where the water was basically flooding, you know, a couple feet of water flooding over that section of Boston, which many, many people have been to. That seemed to, at the time, give a wake-up call to a lot of people who said, oh my God, this climate change, sea level rise thing is real. And that gave some further credibility to studies that were already underway by a group called Climate Smart Boston. I think it's a commission that has been mandated to go off and study what can be done about adaptation to climate change in the city of Boston. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long and short of it, the Boston Globe put up an article recently talking about the following idea. So there's this idea floating around that Boston Harbor should be blockaded by a seawall, literally a wall, a big granite thing that would be built across the harbor, across the islands out in the harbor, for example, from Hull all the way up to Deer Island is one idea. There's a second smaller wall that would be built across the inner part of the harbor to protect Boston in case of high floods. Anyway, long and short of it, this report that came out, we'll link to it, basically called, what do they say what's the show with the kids they call malarkey or something basically this study said forget an $11 billion wall across the outer harbor. It makes much more sense to use soft local adaptation, in particular things like green spaces near the edge of the water to absorb the flood tides that are coming. And that was a much more direct path to acclimating, protecting Boston from rising sea levels than a big $11 billion monstrosity across the entrance to Boston Harbor. I just want to make note of it because there are so many issues that we've talked about in the show more than once in the past, that the idea of adaptation is distinct from the idea of mitigation. Mitigation is a funny sort of technical word, but in climate speak, mitigation means reducing how much carbon emission we put in the air in order to reduce global warming, whereas mm-hmm. adaptation is a question of building or making cities more resilient, or people more resilient, or places more resilient against the inevitable changes that climate change is bringing. And mm-hmm. of course, the moral dilemma there is that every adaptation is local and protects someone who has the power to command the adaptation be built, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas mitigation protects everyone at once. And so it's much more morally attractive. But the fact that, long and short of it, is a lot of people depend on the city of Boston and they don't want it to be flooded out. And so what are you going to do? This mm-hmm. report does a good job of making a common sense call to say that constructing an enormous seawall that won't be, I guess the seawall that is being thought about would not even be complete until the year 2050. So, I mean, there's a lot of storms going to come between now and 2050. And that for the measly sum of $2 billion, you could do a lot of protection of the city of Boston locally. And what they're talking about is doing things like raising, I forget the name of the streets they talked about, but raising some of the highways that run along the water. If they came up, were brought up to 14 feet, they'd be less damaged by storms. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was most attractive is the idea of building what amounts to soccer fields at an elevation, say a 14-foot elevation at various places around the city. Green space is an emerald necklace around the edge of the water that would serve as both a barrier to rising seas and absorb any storm overwash, right? And that protects the downtown. And so these are useful things. And I guess it's interesting in my mind that this discussion is being talked about very matter-of-factly. It's not, we're not talking about whether or not climate change is going to happen, at least in these, at least in Massachusetts, right? It's the discussion of what are we going to do about it? What's the most effective way to address it? And whatever Boston does, there's going to be parts of Massachusetts that are not protected by this this seawall concept. And so we have to always keep in mind the idea of reducing carbon emissions and the use of fossil fuels, because that protects everyone in Boston and Massachusetts and in Bangladesh, right? And so, anyway, that's there, DR. I highly recommend people read it, think about it. It's very, the Boston Globe article, and there was also a discussion on WBUR-GBH, I guess, Bob C. Basically, this is a technical discussion about Boston, but it raises many, many general issues about how people in cities and places ought to be trying to accommodate climate change. So there you go. There you go. That's my spiel on the seawall for this week. The other interesting thing that is coming down the pike, maybe you saw it, DR, is that there is a mayor's conference that's going to happen in the city of Boston on June 7th and 8th. We talked about this a couple of shows ago. This is the National Mayors Conference. They're going to bring in mayors certainly from around the country and I think from around the globe to have a discussion on how cities play in can address climate change on the day before. So did you have you? I mean, I got a point to make, but you've seen that that suggestion, right, DR?
Yes, definitely. And Gina McCarthy, the former EPA administrator, the last real EPA administrator, and former Secretary of State John Kerry will be are scheduled to speak at that mayoral climate conference.
And so, what makes it all interesting and gives the whole thing a certain Bostonian political flavor is the following, and I don't have all the details, so forgive me if I get something wrong, please let us know. But the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, is hosting this conference on June 7th, I think it is. Let me look at my calendar. June 7th, it's a Friday, or 8th, I guess. June 7th or 8th, he's going to have this one-day conference of mayors. But at the same time, the Boston City Council, almost 7 or 8 months ago, passed legislation or whatever amounts to legislation in the city of Boston that the city of Boston should implement community choice aggregation of energy. So what is that? What's community choice aggregation? That's an idea where the city of Boston contracts for the electricity for everyone that lives in the city of Boston. And can because it aggregates all those individual users, it is able to bargain more effectively with the electricity providers. And in particular, from a climate perspective, once you have community choice aggregation of energy, you can now demand that the person supplying you the electricity for your city make it greener and greener and greener, right? It's a, it's a lever, right? Anyway, the Boston City Council passed a referendum or legislation or an ordinance or whatever they pass to cause to allow that to be happening, and Mayor Walsh has not yet implemented that. So there's some pushback from climate hawks in Boston to get the mayor to sign up to the and actually implement this community choice aggregation, even as he is hosting this noble one-day climate conference, right? And
did you see anything on that? What is he waiting for? Exactly. What is he waiting for?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's there. He's, I mean, who knows what he's waiting for? But that is the kind of inside baseball, I suppose you'd say, that would happen around something like a one-day climate conference. The other interesting thing is that there are pipeline projects proposed in the city of Boston. I think that, interestingly enough, there's one. Again, I'm a little bit hazy on the details, so I don't want to overstate, but I think there's a place called a real estate development called the Dalton.
One Dalton.
One Dalton, right? Yeah. So this is not a Trump Tower, but it's a luxury apartments. And my understanding is that that place is, on the one hand, parts of it are going to be under something called Passive House, which is highly energy efficient, but other segments of it will have their own dedicated natural gas pipeline. And the mayor is supporting the construction of another natural gas pipeline to bring natural gas to this big luxury development. Again, sort of at odds with the climate hawk branding that the mayor, I think, would like to have. And did you see anything about the Dalton One thing? I mean, did I get the story right, number one?
One Dalton, and there's been a lot of community pushback against the idea that, you know, we need to be having more buildings reliant upon natural gas, and people wondering how come Walsh, who, you know, dresses up in green clothing, seems to be remaining silent on this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And people are, for obvious reasons in this day and age, very, very sensitive to political greenwashing. And people are obviously not thrilled at what seems to be greenwashing on Mayor Walsh's part here.
Yeah, right. And you don't even touch the huge undercurrent of just the question of whether or not Boston really needs a luxury tower for people to buy $1 million condos in, right? When mm-hmm. you can't even buy a house in Boston once Amazon shows up, right? But that's mm-hmm. that's a whole other story. Yeah, so there you go. I think the other thing to take note of progress here is that there was a sad passing this past week of a Boston icon. And so for mm-hmm. those of you too young to remember or too drugged out to remember, maybe, or whatever. For a long time in Boston, there was a newspaper called the Boston Phoenix. The Boston Phoenix was a beacon of sort of avant-garde, correct me if I'm wrong, DR, but it's sort of avant-garde stuff. It was, might have been free for a while. It wasn't always free, but it was sort of this underground paper. It was, mm-hmm. I think it started as something called Boston After Dark. Is that true?
Yes,
It began as Boston, and it turned into the Phoenix. The Phoenix became, and eventually built itself into being a bit of a powerhouse of literary, you know, journalism. And from what I heard on the radio, the Boston Phoenix was connected to WFNX. If you live in Boston, it's still, right, the FNX, it's FNX for a reason, right? Because mm-hmm. it's connected to the Boston Phoenix, and that this was an attempt at sort of cross-media manipulation long before the internet came along. But anyway, mm-hmm. given that setup, that we have this iconic newspaper, which is now unfortunately gone away, what should people know about DR?
Well, yes, Stephen Mindich, the founder of the Boston Phoenix, passed away this week at the age of 74 after a lengthy battle with pancreatic cancer. The Phoenix was notable, as you know, not only for, you know, its tremendous arts and entertainment coverage, its tremendous journalism that you know, challenged the political establishment, but also, especially towards the end, very, very vocal about the need to take strong action to reduce carbon emissions. They ran great pieces by Wayne Stevenson, by Bill McKibben, by a number of other, you know, passionate speakers on the climate issue. Mm-hmm. And it's just so unfortunate that the paper, due to, you know, the advertising issues that have hurt a lot of newspapers, mm-hmm. you know, went out of business several years ago, right at the time when, you know, papers like the Phoenix could have been very, very significant, at least in this area, if not others, in terms of, you know, continuing to raise awareness, continuing to galvanize people on this issue. It is such a shame that the paper went away. Mindich was very, very passionate about this issue and very, very passionate about the overall causes of social justice in the mm-hmm. United States. Mm-hmm. He'll definitely be missed.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say, since you mentioned the names, we should point out, if people are not familiar or people just learning, when Stevenson wrote some for the Phoenix, when mm-hmm. still lives around Boston, he's an author, he's quite a thoughtful guy, mm-hmm. and writes on, he's now a full-time climate activist, in my understanding, mm-hmm. right? He basically gave up journalism and said he has to work on climate stuff, mm-hmm. And has written a lot of thoughtful articles, so look him up. And of course, Bill McKibben grew up in Lexington, right? So he was cutting his teeth, or at the time that the Phoenix was roaming around as well. So those connections are real, and it's interesting. I mean, it's particularly, as you say, tragic that these smaller regional papers are now, if they can persist, are being bought up by big, you know, Sinclair Broadcasting like entities that just shot. Too bad. Anyway, I would say that in the digital age, the role of the Boston Phoenix has transferred to podcasts. So, D.I., I think someday you are going to be held in high esteem. You know, they're going to have a statue to D.R. Tucker, the podcaster who saved the planet.
We're carrying on a tradition.
We hope to. I'd be proud to do that. Anyway, D.R., we got to put it down there. We will put up links to some of the stuff we talked about on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find the link to the blog and the podcast on the Facebook page at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or any of those modern distribution services, right? Search for Massachusetts Climate Action or the Climate Minute and you'll find us. We are, of course, on Apple Podcasts, what used to be known as iTunes, but is now Apple Podcasts. You can, again, search for Mass Climate Action. Please like us, rank us, it helps. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the President Spankey's administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.